Let's read from 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 5, about events in the second year of King Saul, where he has started acting against the Philistines that have trade outposts and apparently security details at those trade outposts inside Israel proper. And so they're taking those out, getting rid of them, and the Philistines don't like it. So for the first time since the Battle of Ebenezer, which was 17 or 18 years ago, the Philistines muster up for an invasion of the land of Israel. 1 Samuel 13:5, the Philistines mustered to fight with Israel 30,000 chariots, 6,000 horsemen, and troops like the sand on the seashore in multitude. So many tens of thousands of soldiers on wheels, on hooves, and on feet. They came up and encamped at Michmash, to the east of Beth-Aven. Beth-Aven seems to be a town somewhere east of Bethel. And then Michmash is east of Beth-Aven. We know where Michmash is at. And so this brings the Philistines to the very place north of the very place where their trade outpost and where their security detail at that trade outpost were ousted by Jonathan. That was at the town of Gibba. Verse 6, when the men of Israel saw that they were in trouble, for the people were hard-pressed. You know, when you've got that many soldiers showing up, that's pretty scary. And so the people hid themselves in caves, in holes, in rocks, tombs, and cisterns. Some of the Hebrews even crossed the fords of the Jordan to the land of Gad and Gilead. And Saul was still at Gilgal, and all the people following him trembling. So Saul had been made aware of the Philistines getting ready for their little invasion. He'd sounded the shofar, the ram's horn trumpet of assembly, for the militia to meet with him at Gilgal, down by the ruins of Jericho, down in the Jordan Valley. And he's got these people abandoning Israel, abandoning the militia process because they're so scared of how big this Philistine force is. Now, historically, about a year earlier, since this is about the second year of Saul's reign, he had been told by the prophet Samuel, you will be mustering people at Gilgal, and you must wait for me to arrive and do all of the religious blessings before you go to battle. You have to wait for me for 7 days. Now, it appears in this part of the story that that was a test of whether or not Saul would obey. And he fails it. So verse 8 says he waited 7 days, the time appointed by Samuel. But Samuel didn't come to Gilgal, and the people were scattering from him. So Samuel, I believe, intentionally at the direction of the Lord, arrives just before the end of the 7-day waiting period, just before the sun goes down. And so Saul is like freaked out. He is panicking because he knows that he's got to take this muster force up against the Philistines as soon as possible before it shrinks anymore. Samuel hasn't shown up to do the religious ceremonies, the blessing of the chaplain, if you will. So as the sun is getting closer and closer to the western horizon, verse 9 says, Saul said, bring the burnt offering here to me and the peace offerings. And so he offered the burnt offerings. Now, it's likely that it is the high priest that he has with him that does the actual sacrificing at this point. But as soon as he had finished offering the burnt offering, so as soon as the animal carcass went up on to the fire, that's when Samuel shows up, just before sunset, just before the end of the seven-day period. And Saul, he's now happy that Samuel showed up. So he went out to meet him and greet him. So he would have gone out and probably bowed a little bit to him because of age, because of his position as the prophet of Israel, as the judge of Israel that anointed him, may have actually done that two-sided kiss thing, you know, where you grab him by the shoulders and kiss the two cheeks. But Samuel's response is this: "What have you done?" Saul said, "Well, he knows exactly what he's talking about, that he didn't wait. When I saw that the people were scattering from me and that you'd not come within the days appointed." Now, that's not true. He came at the tail end of it, but he came within the period stated. So let's not miss that. Saul is over-exaggerating the direness of the situation. He's trying to make excuses for himself. "So you didn't come within the days appointed that the Philistines had mustered at Michmash. And so I said to myself, now the Philistines are going to come down against me at Gilgal. I haven't sought the favor or the face of he who is." So his concern was the Philistines were going to sweep down on him before they had gotten God's blessing for the coming fight. "So," he says, "I forced myself and offered the burnt offering." So I made myself do something that I didn't really want to do, but needed to be done anyway. I became pragmatic. I did what was necessary because you didn't show up in time. Samuel said to Saul, "You have done foolishly." Now, when we talk about foolishness in the scripture, the Hebrew take on it is that foolishness is not doing things God's way, thinking you know better. The whole period of the judges is a good example of foolishness. There was no king in Israel in those days. People didn't even think about God being their king. So everyone did as they saw fit in their own eyes. They flew by the seat of their pants. They made up their own rules. And so Samuel calls Saul on the carpet for it. He says, "You played the part of a fool. You have not kept the command of he who is your God with which he commanded you." So you were given very explicit instructions, and you didn't do it. If you had, then the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever. So that was the conditionality of it. You see, if Saul had passed his test, his family could have been the dynasty, the royal dynasty of Israel. Now, of course, God already knew it was going to play this way, so there are other prophecies that already indicated that the Judah tribe would be the royal tribe. The two things can be true at the exact same time, that Saul's kingdom could have been the forever kingdom, but God knew about this, and therefore it wouldn't be the forever kingdom. That's the mechanism of God being outside of time and space. But now, and this makes him sad. Samuel is both mad and sad in this context here. But now your kingdom shall not continue. This is his prophetic message to Saul. Here in the second year, think about that. The second year, not two full years, just the second calendar year of Saul's kingdom. And he's being told, you're toast, you're done. Your kingdom is not going to make it. It's not going to survive you. He who is has sought out a man after his own heart, and he who is has commanded him to be prince over his people, because you have not kept what he who is commanded you. Now let's talk about the chronology here. Saul's kingdom is only going to last 20 years. Samuel's leadership as judge lasted 20 years. So together, Samuel and Saul represent 40 years of leadership. And that's actually what is mentioned in the book of Acts, when I think it's Stephen is going over Israeli history, and he talks about 40 years. Now, some people, though, have misunderstood that passage being only about Saul's kingdom, and so they make Saul's kingdom 40 years long, which means that David, under that chronology, wouldn't have been born until the 10th year of Saul's kingdom. But here, there's every indication that David was alive in the second year of Saul's kingdom. And that makes much more sense with only 20 years designated to Saul's kingdom. So I believe that when this story is happening, right here at this moment, David is 11 or 12 years old down at Bethlehem. And the next story is that revolves around David is going to be how he is secretly anointed as the next king of Israel. But God's already got him picked out, and Samuel is already aware of it. Verse 15. So after passing that information on, Samuel arose and went up from Gilgal. So he doesn't stick around because Saul blew it. Saul screwed up the test. And so the rest of the people went up after Saul to meet the army. They went from Gilgal to Gibeah of Benjamin. So the mustered army, such as it is, goes up to the capital city of Gibeah. Saul numbered the people who were present with him, about 600 men. Now that is very sad. It is very telling. And it is very problematic. Remember, before he went to Gilgal, before the Philistines felt the need to invade, Saul had 3,000 people in his standing army. But now, because of the Philistine invasion, he doesn't even have that many people. He's only got 600 guys left. Now, what's he going to do against tens of thousands of chariot, horse, and foot soldiers of the Philistines? He's in a mess. Verse 16. Saul and Jonathan, his son, and the people who were present with him stayed in Gibeah of Benjamin, but the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Now, it would appear that the bulk of the army, the militia forces, are at Gibeah. But Jonathan seems to be up by Geba, where there might be a little outpost keeping an eye on the Philistines across the valley at Michmash, because there's only about a mile and a third or something like that between the city of Geba on the south side of the valley and the city of Michmash on the north side of the valley. Verse 17 tells us a little bit more about what the Philistines are up to this time. The raiders came out of the camp of the Philistines in three companies. So they've set up this massive military encampment, probably north, maybe northwest of the city of Michmash. And they're sending out raiding parties to take Israeli stuff, steal possessions of Israelis, grain and supplies and animals and things of that nature, even slaves. Now, one of those companies turned toward Ophrah to the land of Shu'al. That sounds like probably north of the encampment there in northern central Benjamin. Another company turned toward Beth Horon. That's to the west, the direction from which the Philistines arrived. And so they're probably raiding and taking things along that route. And then another company turned toward the border that looks down to the valley of Zeboim, toward the wilderness. That's clearly toward the Jordan Valley. So they're using this Michmash encampment as a headquarters to spread out all along the northern border of the tribe of Benjamin territory, and they're taking stuff. Verse 19, another little thing I've mentioned before about the situation between the Philistines and the Israelis during the last several years of Samuel's time as judge. There were no blacksmiths to be found throughout all the land of Israel, for the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make for themselves swords or spears. So blacksmithing is a high-tech job. It involves people passing those high-tech skills on to the people following them. And so the Philistines have taken control of that proprietary information. They won't allow Israelis to become blacksmiths. They've done that over a period of time. And probably around the same time that they were establishing their trade outposts inside Israel proper. One of the big items that they probably sold in their outposts were items made with metal components. Verse 20, but every one of the Israelis went down to the Philistines to sharpen his plowshare. So the plowshares would have had that little angled piece of wood that breaks the soil up, but they always put a metal point on the angled wood to kind of protect the wood and break the soil a little bit more easily. His mattock, which is a type of hoe, I believe, made of metal, and his axe or his sickle. The charge was 2/3 of a shekel for the plowshares and for the mattocks, and 1/3 of a shekel for the sharpening of the axe or the setting of the goads. The goads here, probably a reference to the little teeth that were put on the sickles to help in the cutting of the grain. Excuse me. The price seems to be pretty steep. A shekel eventually settles down to represent about 2 days' wages for the common worker. So 2/3 of a shekel means over a day's wage. And 1/3 of a shekel is most of a day's wage. So that's pretty heavy-duty money just to get things sharpened, because you have to have special skills to do that properly and to reset things. Verse 22. And that's why on the day of battle, there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people with Saul and Jonathan, but Saul and Jonathan, his son, had them. This has always puzzled me, and the only explanation I have in response to my own puzzlement, I'm about to tell you. You know that the Israelis have just had a successful fight against the Ammonites, against Nahash. They took the booty. They took the leftover things of the Ammonites when they bugged out, when they ran away back to their territory. But evidently, they did not take military equipment. Why? I don't know. Don't know why that wasn't amongst the plunder. Or did they take it and then sell it in order to buy other things? Whatever the reason, we know that when the Philistine invasion occurred, the common Israeli militia members didn't have military equipment. Only Saul and Jonathan had actual full-fledged swords. Verse 23, and the garrison of the Philistines went out to the pass of Michmash. Now that's a reference to a little outpost that's going to be right on the edge of the valley between Michmash on the north and Geba on the south. And as I told you, between those two cities is about a mile and a third. And the valley, it's a wadi valley. It's been cut. It's got some pretty steep sides. And so you've got an outpost of the Israelis probably on the south side that Jonathan might be, taking charge of. And then you've got the Philistine outpost on the north side of the valley, keeping an eye on the Philistines. Verse 1 of chapter 14. One day, Jonathan, the son of Saul, said to the young man who carried his armor, so to his lieutenant, to his adjutant, the guy that's with him, the trainee possibly that he's trying to show the ropes to, come, let's go over to the Philistine garrison on the other side. So he's on the south side by Geba outpost, and he tells his assistant, let's go down through the ditch, down through the gully, down through the valley, and go up to that Philistine outpost on the other side. But he didn't tell his father. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah in the pomegranate cave or under the pomegranate tree at Migron. The people were with him, about 600 men. We heard that already. That's not an awful lot against the large invasion force of the Philistines. But this group included Ahiyah, the son of Ahitub, who was Ichabod's brother, both of them being sons of Phinehas, who was the son of Eli, the priest of he who is in Shiloh. So, we already know Eli died about 17 or 18 years ago when Phinehas was killed and the Ark of the Covenant was taken. His son Ahitub was a kid at that time, and Ichabod was born right around that time. His name means the glory is gone. Remember all of that? Well, Ahitub has grown up in the time since, and even had a son that has grown up, He's what's passing for a high priest. He's probably very young, but he is functioning as the high priest, and he has the high priest garments on, and the Ark of the Covenant is with them there at Gibeah. It's been brought over from Kiriath-Jearim because of this big battle that's getting ready to happen. They wanted God's throne with them, but here's the thing. The people and Saul did not know that Jonathan was gone. So Jonathan is out here doing this thing secretly, and nobody in the Israeli encampment knows anything about it, including his dad. Now, verse 4, within the passes by which Jonathan sought to go over to the Philistine garrison, there was a rocky crag on the one side and a rocky crag on the other, which just means a big, steep hillside. It's the side of this gully, this wadi. The one was named Bozez, which means very white. And the name of the other was Sinna, which means thorny. So the very white is probably a reference to the limestone that's showing through the erosion. The thorniness, not hard to figure out. We all know that weeds like to grow on the steep sides of gullies. And so here's a bunch of thorny weeds on one side. So the one crag rose on the north in front of Michmash, the other on the south in front of Gibeah. So Jonathan said to the young man who carried his armor, "Come, let's go over to that garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that he who is will work for us, for nothing can hinder he who is from saving by many or by few." Gotta love Jonathan. Jonathan has got a serious faith in God. His dad is sitting south of him just a few miles with only 600 guys, and he's nervous and worried about the battle that's about to take place. Jonathan is up here just a couple of miles south of the big military encampment of the Philistines, and he wants to go up to the little outpost in front of it and take them all on, just himself and his associate, his helper. And he says, it doesn't matter whether it's few or many. God'll do it. And his armor bearer said to him, and you got to love this guy too, "Do all that's in your heart. Do as you wish. Behold, I am with you heart and soul." Mark your place. Next time we get back into the Word, we'll see how God uses Jonathan.